This feeling at the end of the last class, maybe it was just my own confusion, that I had somehow missed some key piece to the explanation of what happens to the correlation length as you rescale into block spins. That maybe there was a piece of the underlying physics that I had forgotten to mention. Okay, so I thought about it, and so in a sense, I may just be reiterating Kadnoff's picture, but I think when I drew it, it's possible that I didn't maybe have this piece up here. So let me just restate the argument for block spins and how things behave. Okay. So first of all, the idea is that we're close to a critical point. And so the correlation length is long, okay? And in particular, it's if you look at this piece of the sample, which is still not a very big piece, but it took me a long time to even draw this, okay? But if you look at the piece of the sample, the correlation length is at least as big as this piece of the sample, okay? So now the idea is the following, that you can look at this sample as a bunch of little icing spins S. And they're spacing, they're spaced by a lattice constant, and they behave like an icing model behaves. And if you know the solution to the icing model, you'll know that the correlation length C is a function of K. And when you solve the problem of the icing model, one of the things that you get is what the correlation length is for all values of K. That's like part of the complete solution for the icing model. Now, let's say that we can obviously divide this crystal here up into blocks. And let's say we divide it up into blocks, and we define block spins. Let's call this guy mu1 and this guy mu2, and so forth. And now, all of a sudden, the spacing between these block spins is not A, but it's 2A. Okay? So the argument is that the solution to the icing model of these spins is just like the solution to the icing model for these block spins, except that there's a renormalized coupling constant, K prime. Now, the point is that this K prime for the mu's is supposed to give you the same physics as the K for the S's. And in particular, we're trying to describe a system where the correlation function decays as you go across it to, say, 1 over E of its starting value, okay? So the point is that these guys should describe the same correlation length. However, the unit of length is now 2A. So for these icing spins that describe a correlation length decaying like that across them, the correlation length function C of K prime is half as many lattice spacings for these guys. So in other words, this is equal to twice C of K prime. Or in other words, this correlation length for these mu's is half what it was, what these guys saw. So the point is that these are sort of two ways of looking at the icing model. This is for the, you know, one set of spins, and this is for the, after you've blocked those spins together and said, oh, gee, that's an icing model too. Okay, if you do all the steps right. Okay. But that's what gives rise to that. And similarly, then, it goes without saying that if you call this nu1 and nu2 and so forth, and this distance here now is 4a, that, and this coupling constant now between these guys is k double prime, and k double prime is the value of the coupling constant that says that the correlation length is four of these spaces. And in a correlation length, the correlation function decays to roughly 1 over e. Okay? So then this is equal to 4 but I just want to emphasize this point, that if each of these things is an Ising model, then each of them should be described by the same function, C of k. Okay? And that then immediately, but here you've only got 4 block spins in a correlation length. Here you've got 8, and here you've got 16. Okay? So I don't know whether I've subtracted from or added to your confusion, but I found that picture seemed to make things make more sense in my own mind. Okay, so that's that. So. This is all in the context of a single coupling constant problem. Now, and last time we talked about how you can derive the recursion relations for an Ising model with a single coupling constant and extract the exponents from the derivative of the recursion relation at the fixed point. But we also pointed out that except for the simple one-dimensional model, where it's easy to go from one Ising model to another just by tracing out spins. In general, in higher dimension, it's not as simple as that. You try to map spins into block spins, and you generate extra couplings. And that makes things more complicated. And so what we need is a general theory. For RG transformations, basically in the space of many coupling constants. And this is what I mean by that. So you can write a very general Hamiltonian. Let's call it minus beta Hn, which depends on Ising spins. That looks like this. Call this delta 1, which is nearest neighbors. And then you can go on. Oh, sorry, I went from sigmas to s's. I shouldn't have done that. Why did I do that? Okay, I'm not reading my notes. keep going. Okay. And basically for icing spins, there's all kinds of products. You can either have products of pairs that are nearest neighbors and second neighbors and so forth. You can have products of triples, which are, say, correspond to some shape on the lattice, like a little triangle here. And then you can have products over fours, like that. And actually, you can imagine that each one of these terms is, just like this, there's two possible pair interactions, but you could also have third neighbor interactions and so forth. And similarly with these three spin and four spin interactions, the shape of the diagram on which the four or three spins or five spins sit could have many different possibilities. But nevertheless, I think you can imagine that you could write down everything, and it would just mean that there were a lot of coupling constants that describe the absolutely most general case. So for instance, we're going to call this a set of coupling constants, which is basically, for this Hamiltonian, the set that would have K1, K2, K3. K4, and so forth. So these are coupling constants. And these guys in here, actually, let me. These things are often called operators. So forth. Because of some analogy to quantum field theory, which I'm not going to attempt to go into. So you can imagine, actually, if I just said, well, I've got this string of operators, of all possible operators, and this string of all coupling constants, and the Hamiltonian is just the scalar product of those. You know, this times operator one, this times operator two, this times operator three, and so forth. One way of looking at it. Now, of course, for the icing model, when you start, all of these are zero except for the first two. Right? That's your nearest neighbor icing model in a field. Okay, so that's, if you like, you can think of that as your starting Hamiltonian. But what I've been telling you, and you may have even come to this conclusion on your own, that as you do a renormalization group transformation, you start to generate other ones. And eventually, you could generate all of them. You've got a lot of energy. Okay, so let's try to formulate renormalization group theory in this language. So we can define some untraced partition function. Let's follow my notation. I'm going to call this HN minus beta H, just so that I don't get confused here. then a renormalization group transformation will look like this. Some transformation function of spins. So this thing here is a, if you like, an untraced partition function. If you trace this over the sigmas, you get the partition function. Okay? And that's minus t log of that is the free energy. So basically what I'm saying is that, so this is for a system with coupling constants k and size n and spins sigma. So what I'm saying is that you can write an RG transformation as for a system with coupling constants k prime, number of spins mu, spins mu, of which the number is n over l to the d. You can generate this by tracing over all the spins with some transformation matrix. That is the renormalization group transformation. Okay, how you construct this is basically when you construct in this, you build in the physics of the blocking that you're going to do, or whatever it is that you're going to turn a bunch of spins sigma into a new spin mu. That physics should be built into here. Okay. However, one constraint on this operator T, let me write it this way, T of mu and sigma must satisfy that the trace over the mu's is 1. And why is that? Because if that's true, then if I trace the left-hand side of this definition here, so basically, what's this? This is the partition function, the real partition function. And this transformation is supposed to preserve the value of the partition function, which is to say the partition function for the new spins with coupling constants k prime should be the same as for the original spins with coupling constants k. Okay. that clear? Yeah.
I have two questions. So first one, the second question, so trace of a sigma means trace of a part of the spin.
Trace over all of these spins.
Oh, trace over.
You can write it like this if you prefer.
Oh, yeah, I see.
Okay.
So,
same thing here.
Also, would you mind giving the exact form of the transformation?
Of T?
The
transformation okay.
For the, if you trace like of a half of the thing, or if you do the majority root.
Right. Wow, what a nice question. Yes. Okay. So you might wonder what, I mean, actually, I'll try not to dwell on this because it quickly gets boring because there's so many different T's that you could write down. So I'll just give you an example of a simple one, okay? So what is? And so when I say that, I don't mean what is T, I mean what are some examples of simple T's? So you can write, so this is what I call a useful form. I mean, there might be more than one useful form, but anyway. So this is the number of mu spins, 1/2, 1 plus mu I, some little t I of the sigmas. So n mu, then I guess we would call n over L to the d. And the idea would be the following. Usually, if you have a geometrical picture of the relationship between your block spins and your original spins, then this function here for block spin I would involve the spins, this T would involve the spins that are close to spin I. Okay, but still you would have some flexibility there. This explicitly obeys the this property that that if you sum over mu I of one of these terms, ti of mu I sigma, that's equal to the sum over mu I equals plus or minus 1/2 times 1 plus mu I ti, which is equal to basically 1/2 times 1 plus ti plus 1 minus ti, which is 1. Okay, so that's just constructed so that if mu I is an Ising spin, then this traces to 1. That's for this, your whole thing is a product of those. So if you trace over all the mu I's, you get 1. So the so-called majority rule for three spins can be written as, say, T sigma 1, sigma 2, sigma 3 is something like a half times sigma 1 plus sigma 2 plus sigma 3 minus sigma 1, sigma 2, sigma 3. Okay. And so then you can see, for instance, if the majority of sigma 1s are positive, let's look at those cases, then you'd have 1 half of 1 plus 1 plus 1 plus a half of 1 plus 1 minus 1. But there's actually three ways you can have this. And so what am I trying to say? 1 plus 1 plus 1 plus or minus 1. Okay, sorry. So if all the spins are up, this gives you 1 plus 1 plus 1 minus 1. And that's 1. If one of the spins is down, you get 1 plus 1, say, minus 1, plus 1. And that's 1. So basically, this gives you plus 1 if the majority of the spins are up. And then just by taking all the spins to minus themselves, it gives you minus 1 if all the spins are down. Oh, sorry, if the majority of the spins are down. OK? Is that obvious? So I'm just trying to write what this is. For one case, it's that. For the other cases, it's always something like that, but the product is plus when you include this minus sign. And so any way you cut it, this is 1 equals 1 if majority is
signifies the
gives you this result.
Yeah, I thought you said that that signifies the preservation of the value of the partition function by the renormalization transformation.
Yes.
Now, in the bottom equation, on the left hand side, I see a trace over a partition function, and on the right hand side, I see just a partition function.
Sorry, this is dead end. This is well, okay.
Trace of a partition function z?
This is a partial partition function. It's the thing whose trace is the whole partition function.
Oh, okay.
Just like this is.
Okay. Partial partition.
Which just means that the whole partition function is what you get when you add this up over all possible values of the mu's. Just like this is true. If you trace this over all possible values of the sigmas, you get the partition function. Right.
Yeah, I'm used to thinking of trace of x eats the negative beta h as partition function. So
right.
I was a little confused to see the z on the left.
Well, that's just because that's e to the minus beta h. That's exactly what it is. That's the definition. That's what this is the definition.
Okay, I just encountered not quite that notation before. But it's clear now. Thank you.
Okay, yep. Okay, so I don't know if you want me to belabor this or not, but basically this, if you work this through, I think you're probably just as well off doing this yourself. I mean, I have all the steps here, but if you start with this transformation, then your mu's obey the majority rule in the sense that this T will be 1 for mu equals 1 if the majority of the sigmas are up. And it will be 0 for mu equals 1 if their majority is down, and vice versa. This T for when mu is minus 1 will be 1 if the majorities of the sigmas are down. And it will be, it'll be 1 if the majorities of the sigmas are down, if mu is minus 1, and it'll be 0 if the majority of sigmas are down, if mu is plus 1. So basically, it locks the value of mu to the majority of the sigmas. Okay. I think you have to play with it to see. But it's a standard transformation for three spins, and then you can generalize it to more spins. Okay. So, because of the fact that this thing describes this describes n over l to the d spins. With coupling constants, as the starting Hamiltonian, we think we should be able to write so we can express it as the exponential of this general Hamiltonian to within a constant. Or if you like, we could have put a constant term in our definition of the list of coupling constants. Then the operator that corresponded to that constant is 1. I could have done that up here by putting a constant. The operator is 1. Constant sits up in front. That's what we call this. So basically, this transformation that takes us from our original problem via this T that we use to this new problem defines a new Hamiltonian of the same form as the original Hamiltonian, same operators, except they're written as products of mu's. but with different coupling constants, k prime. So in other words, so this T of mu and sigma that defines a set of recursion relations. Okay. And we can write that as Ki prime is equal to Ri of the original Ks. Transformation. It doesn't have any catchy name. It is the RG transformation. Basically, it's completely defined by that. Okay, but it's defined by that for a system which has this totally general Hamiltonian, and which involves all of these different operators. It gives you a transformation between that system and the equivalent system with a smaller number of these mu's, but the same form for the Hamiltonian. So, as we always do, if we define the free energy per sigma spin as 1 over n log of the trace over the sigmas Zn, then this transformation should preserve the value of the free energy. Well, actually, what am I? Whoops, let me see what my then is. Well, it will, actually. Okay, so if the free energy is preserved, then, which I think, I guess, was guaranteed by this property of the transformation, that its trace over the mu's was 1, then we can write the free energy either way.
Is that f of k or f of k prime, the last line?
Yes, it's f of k prime. Sorry. No, it's f of k. It's f of k. That's the point. It's equal. F of k prime would probably be something to do with this. Well, actually, what I was going to write, in fact, now. So the point is that f of k prime is actually this is 1 over L to the d f of k prime. Right, because we've divided everything through by n, but this trace, this log of the trace of this Hamiltonian here, which is the Hamiltonian for n over L to the d icing spins with coupling constants k prime, is just exactly f, the icing free energy, as a function of these coupling constants k prime. Okay? So this expression that I've written down is called an inhomogeneous scaling relation. And it's inhomogeneous because although the transformation preserves the value of the, conserves the value of the total free energy, the total free energy actually divides up into a free energy for coupling constants k prime, n over L to the d of those, plus this constant that got pulled out here. Okay. So
yeah. Yeah. Question. Yeah. So why is that expression not equal to f k prime? You just
which one?
So the second line you wrote.
This
first
one?
Equality, the second line.
This one here.
Yeah. So after the first equality, isn't that the same expression as above, but then for the k prime system? Oh, because there's the
no, because that was because of the fact that the way this z was defined, it was defined by the renormalization group transformation T, which has this property that when you trace it over mu, you get 1. So this thing that we've done down here is exactly the same as this. Okay? This z for n over L to the 2, L to the d spins is defined in terms of that renormalization group transformation. It has the property that if you trace it over mu, which is what we're doing here, you get back the thing that we called f, exactly. OK, that's the way we set it up. Yeah.
Yeah, this is something that confused me too while reading Cardi's book. So I think it's fair to say here that when we say we define f of k equals that, that's really before we do our
This is just the starting Hamiltonian.
Yeah.
This is the
Which
original problem.
Which doesn't include any factors of n, g, k.
No, definitely not. Yeah.
In general, we defined f by the expression that is in that dotted circle.
Right. Or alternatively.
Oh, so there's not definition for any k.
It's only for the
one stage.
This is for the original problem.
Oh, so it's not
okay.
So you cannot do that for every stage. No, so you cannot just put in k prime and mu instead of.
No, but this equation here is true. You see what I'm saying? That this equation here, where I've defined 1 over n, so what is, did I do this backwards? Alpha minus d f n. Yeah. Let's see, 1 over n to the L sub d of this is f. So. Yeah, okay. I'm confused as to whether I've got my else. I think it's right. Okay. So the point is that this thing here equals that is exactly the same as this equation.
Yeah. So in this case, the hyperscaling, you have the hyperscaling the F goes to the L2, right? Where you rescale the system.
Right. Yeah, this F is per spin.
Yeah.
Per mu. Right.
So you already take the hyperscaling hypothesis that F goes to
there. Well, I haven't taken any hypothesis. I mean, this is just this just starting from the beginning, and in other words, this is just an identity. If that equation, these two. If these two relations are satisfied, then this is an identity.
Yeah.
So it's not, I haven't put in any extra assumption. It's just that somehow I've constructed a T that does this.
But take that the F goes to the L D. F scales like L to the power minus D.
Yeah, I mean, it's like giving you that result, I guess, is the.
No, you define f of k prime to be 1 over n over l to the d, because that's the number of spins you have after you have done one step of log of trace e to the h, blah, blah, blah.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, this equation saying this equals this means that this f itself is 1 over n to the l to the d times this. Yeah, that's what Anna just said. Yeah.
I think there shouldn't be an n there. It should just be gk.
Here?
Yeah.
No. You need that because everything up here scales with the size. This is the definition of g.
Then the next equation should have it too, right?
No, because I've divided both sides by n. I've divided that out.
You take the log and then 1 over 1 of the n. So it's the n. Okay.
Okay, now, so the next so now the next comment that I'd like to make is that there's an assumption I think you can convince yourself of that these recursion relations are analytic functions of the k prime is an analytic function of the k's, but the free energy, because of the n goes to infinity limit that you're taking for this system, the free energy itself can be non-analytic at critical points. Okay, so as a result, and this is also an important step. So let me just write that down. The ki ri of the set of k's Why is that? I guess it's because it comes from blocking together sort of a finite number of spins that are locally associated with the block spin that you're transforming to. So you just take a finite number of them and transform them into a new block spin. In any case, these are analytic. You can imagine that something bad might happen, so that it's not. And this g of k, which is the result of doing one step of a transformation, that's analytic. But the free energy itself, as a function of its coupling constants, is not analytic, as we've seen, at phase transitions and at critical points. And so you can equate the singular parts. So that the singular part of f as a function of the coupling constants is L to the minus d times the singular part. Where these k's, k primes come from the k's via the recursion relations. Also implicit in all of this is that the correlation function for the Ising model, for this general Ising model, that was essentially by construction. That's how we define it. By reducing the number of degrees of freedom by L to the D. So this gives us the homogeneous scaling relation. I think we said exactly the same thing when we were working in terms of a single coupling constant or just H and T. But this is for this general function of many, many coupling constants. We're doing good. Okay. So now I'd like to go on and look at the scaling behavior around fixed points in this general coupling constant space. So we have these recursion relations, let's say for coupling constant A. General coupling constant KB. So in general, these things will have fixed points. star. So you have to, in order to, well, we're basically, so this will be equal to K A star, which is equal to R A so if you're at the fixed point in this K space, you do the recursion relation and you get exactly for each one of these Ks, you get exactly the value that you started with. Okay? So that's a fixed point. And these are the points which control, we're going to now explain that why these are the points that control the critical behavior. Okay, so do you understand the notation? This says that for each of the coupling constants at the fixed point, its value is equal to what you get when you do the recursion relation on the set of coupling constants that define a fixed point. Okay, so if you think of this multi-dimensional space, you start at some general point, you do a recursion relation, you move to some nearby point, perhaps. But there are points in this coupling constant space where if you start at that point and do a recursion relation, you stay there. Those are called fixed points. Just as we had for the case of a single coupling constant. And so if you know a fixed point, we can linearize around it. By which I mean linearize the recursion relation, well, recursion relation around. So say that K is not quite at a fixed point, but it's close. See if I can do this without getting into trouble. No, let's not. Let's just do what I was going to do. You can write this as a coefficient matrix times this is okay. So basically, if you start at some point that is nearby a fixed point, so that every k is a little bit different from from the fixed point value, then the new k prime that you get for all different values of a, its distance from the fixed point will be determined by this matrix of partial derivatives, which basically tells you, you know, the slope in that direction. And this thing is not, in general, symmetric. So if you like, if you think in terms of, say, two coupling constants, you're the fixed point there. So the question is if you start off at some point just close by, let's say that that's close by, and you do one renormalization transformation, there's two questions. One is, which way is it going to move? And the second one is, how much? Okay? So say this guy is going to move to a point here. Well, I'm not sure that's... right. Okay, that's probably right. There will, in general, be some directions where if you start out very close to the fixed point, things move here or move here, say, if you start along this line. And then I guess what I should have picked, okay, something like that, if I picked a general point. There'll be certain directions in which if you start off in that direction, you keep going in that direction. Okay. And these are related to the eigenvalues and eigenvectors of this matrix. Okay. It tells you, if you like, what the principal directions are around the fixed points for things to flow out or in. Okay. And if you're at some other point that's not along one of those vectors, what happens will be some combination of things, depending on what combination of these two vectors you've started with. So let me just write this formally. We can define left eigenvectors, which we'll call EIA, say, and eigenvalues lambda I, such that okay, so this is the, if you like, an eigenvector of t. If you dot t into that, you get back lambda times this same vector. So then you can define scaling variables which are ui, which is sum over a eia ka minus ka star. In terms of these. So this is a particular linear combination of coupling constants. So if you like, it's some direction that you've gone off from k star. And given that definition, then, OK, so then the question is, what happens if you take this combination of k's and do a renormalization group transformation? On the ith scaling field. We're going to do a renormalization group transformation on this, which means we're going to change all the k's, all these k's into k primes. Okay? And we'll call the result u prime. And that's going to be, as I just said, yes, I have written that. OK, good. So this is what I said. You do a renormalization group transformation. You start out with some k's that define a value of the scaling field. You get some new k primes. And they define this scaling field, which is the renormalized scaling field after one RG step. And it's written in terms of these k prime minus k prime minus k star. So this is the sum over A and B, EIA, the eigenvector. And for this, I'm going to put in this expression. This is the effect of the renormalization group transformation on a set of these k's. And then this sum over A, because remember this E is the left eigenvector of T. Yes, Nicole?
All right. So in the equation for u sub I prime, you started off with a sum over A. And then when you're substituting in an expression for the parenthetical factor, don't we need to put in another sum?
No, that's just a type of it.
This is a mistake. Sorry. Thank you. OK, so this sum over A, then, just gives you the eigenvalue this thing here you can just factor out. And what's left is the scaling field UI. So the result is that if you rewrite your coupling constants in terms of these scaling fields, then the effect of a RG transformation is that each one gets multiplied by a constant, which is the eigenvalue of this transformation matrix, this partials of the transformation. So ui prime okay. So the way if you look at a deviation from the fixed point along the direction of one of these scaling fields, do a renormalization group transformation, the next point is along that direction, either in or out.
Could you look at the Hessian as well to analyze the fixed point if you want to know how the flow behaves around the fixed point?
What's the Hessian? Second derivative. That would just give you more. That would allow you to do a more accurate. But the point is that what we're interested in is the linear region, because it's in the linear region where we have these well-defined exponents. Where things are changing by a factor every time we do the RG transformation. Okay, so in a sense, when we analyze the problem, we stay within this region where you get this linear behavior, just as the critical region in the physical system where you get power laws is some narrow range around the critical point. What gives you the power laws is this behavior of the scaling field. Okay, so if you go to higher order, then what you're doing is, if you like, corrections to scaling. Okay, so now I just wanted to mention that there's also conventionally we would write lambda I is b to the yi. So this is your exponent. Do I want to call this B or L? I guess I should call it L here. Is that right? Okay, so there's three cases. Case one, or call it A, is yi greater than 0. That means that lambda I is greater than 1. So in that case, ui is said to be relevant. So by relevant, we mean that it grows under the renormalization group scaling. Okay, so that scaling field, ui, is relevant if it gets bigger. And then the other case is yi less than 0, which means that lambda I is less than 1. And then the scaling field ui is called irrelevant. So those couplings flow to zero under renormalization group transformations, and they effectively disappear from the problem. So that you can see that it's the relevant ones that are going to control the behavior around the fixed point. And then, of course, you can also have this case, C, where yi is zero, in which case ui is called marginal. And so I guess you would say that you have to look more closely to see what the effect of that particular combination of coupling constants does.
Sorry, do you mean the magnitude of lambda I is for B? You meant to say lambda I is a fraction, right? It's not negative, but negative, less than one.
If y I is negative, lambda I is less than one.
As in the modulus of what? The lambda one, lambda I.
This eigenvalue here.
Yeah,
so if y I is negative, then the scaling field gets smaller, which means that that's like the eigenvalue is less than one.
Yeah.
Is that okay? Am I saying it wrong or?
No, I'm just saying I'm just trying to make a point that it's not a negative number. It's just a fraction.
The exponent is negative.
Yeah, the exponent is negative, but lambda I is a fraction.
Yeah, no, lambda I is a fraction. It's a positive fraction. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so for the Ising model, U1, which is K minus K star, the nearest neighbor coupling constant, is relevant. H, which is H, let's call it U2.
Is this the IC model in any dimension?
No, oh yeah, in any dimension. For D less than 4. So some other coupling constants let's say, for example, K2 are irrelevant. So you can imagine, maybe I can draw these pictures over here. You can imagine working in some space of U1, U2, U3, and see what the flows would be for the Ising model. So U2 is H, so basically it flows like this. If it's relevant, it flows to larger values. And this is K minus K star, so that also flows like this. And if you work along this axis for U3, which is, say, for instance, the second neighbor coupling, it will flow to 0. So you might imagine that in this space that you start out with a Hamiltonian which has K1, K2, let's work with H equals 0 for simplicity. So you'll start out with the nearest neighbor coupling and a second neighbor coupling, you're trying to solve that model. And the renormalization group flows. So initially, at your starting point, would be something like U3 naught. And if U1 is, say, positive, then the flow would look something like this in the H equals 0 plane. So I'm going in the horizontal plane here defined by U1 and U3. If you start over here, Whereas if you start over here, the flow would be like that. Okay. And so if you like, the sequence of coupling constants that you get changes dramatically as U1 crosses this line here of U1 equals 0. You go from a flow that's out that way to a flow that's this way. If we go back to if we work in terms of some bare coupling constants, K1 and K2, yeah, Mary.
Sorry, I think I missed something here. Can you define U1 as K minus K?
Star. Star.
K minus K star.
K minus K star.
So that's not K1 or K.
Well, it's K1. I mean, this is for the icing model. This is when I said for the icing model, I meant the nearest neighbor icing model.
Oh, nearest neighbor.
Okay. So now what I'm saying is, imagine that you have a more general model that has K1 and K2. Then you'll have a more complicated flow diagram. Actually. So this is a picture in which the coupling constants are a little bit more mixed up around the fixed point. That if you start here, so remember I said K1 is relevant, but actually here, if you look at how you flow to large K, and on this side, how you flow away from the fixed point, you're flowing along a line which is actually some combination of K1 and K2. Okay, but basically you can think of this as your, whatever this direction is, it's the direction of your relevant coupling constant. And you flow away from the fixed point along that direction. And in this direction here, you have an irrelevant coupling constant, which is predominantly K2, the way I've drawn it. Okay, which flows to 0. And in this case here, imagine that you just have, well, for instance, say you have K2 equals 0 as your starting Hamiltonian.
Should it be K2 minus K star?
Well, I've now drawn everything in K star is K2 star, K1 star, K2 star here. See, I've drawn the fixed point here. These are U's. Okay, so U's the fixed points at 0.
Yes.
But if you then unfold that and say, let's just write it in terms of the actual coupling constants without subtracting off the fixed point,
yes,
then the fixed point will be somewhere, yeah, and it'll be there in this case. So this is K1 star, K2 star. Okay? Yeah. And the flow is still away or towards the fixed point. Okay, so the flow is measured with respect to the fixed point in this unfolded way. Yeah.
In general, do relevant couplings cause away from fixed points and irrelevant cause?
Right, and that's exactly this. The fact that lambda is 1, which means when you do the step, if you're away from the fixed point, the distance gets larger. You move to a larger distance away. And here, if lambda is less than 1, you move towards it. So imagine that you have no second neighbor coupling. In this picture, just to say what this illustrates, imagine that you have a nearest neighbor icing model, and you're varying the coupling constant, the nearest neighbor coupling constant over T. So you're varying the temperature, basically. Okay. So So basically, you're starting at some point along this line, k2 equals 0. That's the nearest neighbor Ising model, where k is the coupling, nearest neighbor coupling over temperature. So you start out at some point, and then what happens under renormalization group transformations is that you follow some path. So for instance, you might follow a path like that. If you start from here. But alternatively, if you start from here, you'll follow a path like that. So one comment that I would make is that a way to think of this picture is that your starting point could be any place, and in K1 and K2, and every one of those corresponds to a different starting Hamiltonian. Okay? But as long as you're working in the space of Hamiltonians that are defined by K1 and K2, what happens under renormalization group transformation, renormalization group flows, is still completely controlled by the same fixed point. So this concept of so-called universality, which is the same behavior for many different Hamiltonians, this is a sort of a very, very simple illustration of that. That any first and second neighbor Ising model, its behavior will be determined by this fixed point. And you can see that if you're all on, say its nearest neighbor Ising model, K2 equals 0, there are these two different regimes, one where you flow to infinite coupling constant, which would be interpreted as the ordered state, and one where you flow to zero coupling constant, which would be interpreted as the disordered state. Okay, and this line here, which is called the critical surface, separates the behavior of ordered versus disordered for any one of these models. Okay? So, we made it. And sorry I went on for so long, but we wanted you to have these pictures in mind because they're related to the things that you've been doing in the tutorial and will be doing in the homework. So, but I think at this point we better stop. Yes?
It was a beautiful meaning of this.